Hi, my name is Tom Phillips. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. Whether this is your first visit or your 400th, you are welcome here. Unitarian Universalism strives to embrace and include all in a loving and caring community. Whether you've come, wherever you've come from, whoever you are, and whoever you love, whatever your journey has been, we are so happy that it has led you here today. Okay, I'd like to call your attention to the announcements that are in the order of worship, and they should be complete at this time. We invite visitors and guests, if you have not already done so, to sign our guest book out in the narthex just as you come in at the welcome table. And I'm reminded also to invite all of you for coffee and conversation in the Alsop room after service. And the Alsop room is down the hall to the left, a large fellowship hall. And we will have coffee and other beverages. Okay. So we light the chalice at UU's around the world. And I will light this chalice for the web of life which sustains us, for the sacred circle of life in which we have our being, for the earth, the sky, above and below, for our Mother Earth, and for the mystery. And please join, as you are able, to join us in singing hymn number 40, The Morning Has a Signal. The morning hangs a signal. Okay, I forgot the NG in my... Now is the time in our service when we share those significant joys and sorrows that we carry in our hearts and minds. By sharing heavy burdens, they are lightened. By sharing joys, they grow. We have a microphone that will come around, so please wait for that. And first, Reverend Johnstone has a few words to say.
Again, we've had a week of tragedies and injustice and violence. I wrote a blog column, so I won't repeat my thoughts. I simply this morning want to honor our feelings and emotions in response to the events, and I want to read the names. So I want to read the names of those who've been shot this week and recognize the pain that exists in their friends and families, in their communities. I've been in touch a fair amount with the ministers, Unitarian ministers in Baton Rouge and in Minneapolis and St. Paul and in Dallas. And there's just so much pain and heartache from this. So we want to remember Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, Michael Smith, Michael Kroll, Patrick Zamarripa, Brent Thompson, and Lauren Ahrens.
Good morning, Susan Adamchak. For many years, this fellowship has supported the Peggy Bowman Second Chance Fund as part of our Second Sunday donation program. Peggy Bowman passed away this week at age 75 after a long battle with heart disease. For those of you who have been attending the dialogues about death and dying that we've had, you might want to look at her obituary in today's Wichita Star. Is it Wichita Star? Eagle. For a very bold, fierce, funny obituary, which very much emblemizes Peggy and how she lived her life. I'd also like to just make a request for some assistance. If you read the paper this morning, you saw that K-State is hosting 26 young African leaders for several weeks. I had a chance yesterday to meet with two of those who are visiting from Kenya. One is a woman living with cerebral palsy who was pictured in the paper. Another is a young man who's working with the trans community in Kenya, which, as you can imagine, has got a number of challenges. They're trying to connect with people in our community who may be able to just engage in discussion about how they approach community engagement around both developmental disabilities and sexuality issues. So if anyone has any suggestions for resources, can you please look for me after the service?
So I started my first job this week. I'm a lifeguard. And yesterday was a pretty exciting day. I saved my first life yesterday. So that was interesting and exciting, and now I finally know I can trust myself to do it, which I'm very proud of myself for doing.
I'm not sure whether the actual date is yesterday or today, but Rosalind and Jimmy Carter are celebrating their 70th anniversary. And I just think they're both such wonderful people that we should recognize that.
Here in about a week and a half, on the 20th, Matt and I are making the trek to Virginia to attend Sarah Lott and Alex Stinson's wedding. So if anyone wanted to send a card or anything or well wishes, we'd be happy to deliver that to them. So just come talk to me.
All right. For all those joys and sorrows spoken or in our hearts, let us be mindful. Well, next on our program is The Story for All Ages, which will be a little different today. Not a story out of a book, but it's going to be a skit. Do we have some children who would like to come forward? And you can sit right on the front row of the theater. And I'll tell you, in New York, those tickets would be really expensive for this. All right, so our story for all ages. Oh, good, good, good. Yeah. Very cool. All right. So this story is called The Lucky Little Seaweed, and our narrator is Stacy Brofman.
Once upon a very long time ago, 430 million years ago, to be more precise, there lived a sad little seaweed near the shore of a shallow sea. The little seaweed loved its warm and well-lit aquatic home, but the neighborhood was becoming more dangerous with each passing week. Big, fast-growing seaweeds were beginning to crowd the area and shade out the smaller, less aggressive forms. Voracious animals who swam or crawled within the ocean had developed a taste for seaweed salad. These animals were becoming more numerous every day and were even beginning to threaten the seaweeds that lived right next to the shore in the saltiest water, a zone that used to be safe. The sad little seaweed was feeling the pinch of increased competition. One dreary morning in the shade of a newly grown patch of aggressive seaweed, the little seaweed was visited by an aquatic fungus who was passing by. The fungus was the first to speak.
Excuse me, little seaweed, but I'm about to infect and eat you.
Why would you want to do that?
Well, it is getting harder and harder to make a living on this part of the seafloor. You see, I normally prefer to eat dead organic matter, like old decayed parts of seaweed. But voracious animals have been devouring my favorite foods before I get my share. With their fleshy fins or crabby claws, these animals move faster and faster than I can stretch my fungal fingers, called hyphae.
Hey, I have a similar problem. Beneath these big seaweeds, I can't find enough light to grow. The big seaweeds are shading me out and leaving me weak. The future looks bleak. So you might as well infect me and get it over with.
The fungus was happy to oblige. Fungal fingers, what scientists call hyphae, gently probed the little seaweed, entering here and there, beginning to suck away the living fluids, molecule by molecule. Just then, there was a major earthquake. A portion of the seaweed, or the seafloor, heaved upward, becoming land, and the seawater drained away. The big seaweeds went tumbling back into the ocean, carried along by the ebbing water. But the little seaweed, anchored as it was to the fungus, was left stranded ashore. The little seaweed was the first to speak.
Now what? The water's way down there, but we're up here. Even if you do finish me off, how can you possibly survive when exposed to the drying air like this?
Golly, you are a sweet little seaweed. I would like to... Am I the right place? Oh. Following a script is difficult for a fungus.
For a fungus, yeah.
No problem. My hyphae can grow down, down into the mud just as easily as I can grow deeper and deeper into you. I can grow my fungal fingers down as far as I need to. When they reach water, I just suck it up. So you see, I'm in no danger of drying out. But you are. I suppose I ought to get as much out of you as I can before the sun bakes you to a crisp.
The fungus continued sucking out the living fluid from the little seaweed, molecule by molecule. But in the bright sun, the little seaweed was beginning to taste different. The fungus discovered that the living fluids it was feasting upon were becoming sweeter and sweeter.
Mm.
Fungus.
Oh, fungus. Okay. Golly, you are a sweet little seaweed. I would like to taste your sweetness forever. It seems a shame to kill you.
I'm sweet because I'm finally getting enough sunlight. There are no other seaweeds up here shading me out, and when I get enough sunlight, I can create lots of sugar by photosynthesis.
That is a most admirable talent.
The fungus was beginning to see the little seaweed in a new light. Suddenly, the fungus had a bright idea.
Hmm. Little Seaweed, I have a proposal for you.
I'm listening.
You know, my hyphy can provide nutrition as well as take it away. That is my special talent, controlling the flow of water and nutrients. The interesting thing is that I can just as easily send you fluids as suck them out of you.
The little seaweed felt a glimmer of hope shimmer through its bright green gelatinous skin. The seaweed now turned toward the fungus and begged with excitement.
Oh, fungus, please tell me more.
Well, if I provide you with water and mineral nutrients, can you guarantee me a continuous supply of sugar?
Oh, yes. In this bright sunlight, I can produce much more sugar than I could possibly use all by myself. I'm afraid of drying out, of course. But you appear to have already solved that problem for both of us.
The two former enemies now turn to face one another.
I think we have a deal.
Indeed.
Thus began the most fruitful collaboration of all time, the coming together of seaweed and fungus to form an entirely new kind of life on Earth, land plants. So now, every time you admire a great oak tree, or run across a lovely green lawn, or munch on a salad, remember the lucky little seaweed and this tale of teamwork on the ocean's edge. The end.
Hearts go with you, go enjoy our hopes, go to learn in love and grow in wisdom, shine your light in all you do. Go in love, our hearts go with you, go enjoy our hopes, go to learn in love and grow in wisdom, shine your light in all you do.
As I get out of character here. All right, so before the offering, this is a reminder that the second Sunday of every month is our Helping Hand Sunday. And this is when the fellowship dedicates its collection from the basket to go to a chosen, often local beneficiary. This Sunday, our helping hands are extended to the guardian angels. And here to tell us about the guardian angels is Vern Hendrick, perhaps. And in place of Vern, I think Vern and I are Facebook friends, so he might hear about this. Anyway, in place of him, we have the very competent Michael Oldfather.
Unaccustomed as I am to speaking from this place, I will do what I can. Vern is a lot snappier dresser than I am, and he has other qualities that I lack. But I am a board member of the Guardians, and we are the male counterpart to the fairy godmothers. They led the way, and we have copied much of what they do. And our basic mission is to help males who have somehow or other gotten in a ditch, getting out and get on their way. We make grants of generally up to $600 or so, often for car repairs so that the gentleman can get to work and or to provide child care or whatever it is that he may be doing. A lot of our purchases, our gifts, have bought beds for men who have moved to town to take a job, have an unfurnished apartment, and need a bed. things like that. Car repairs are fairly common. I want to tell you one story that to me is perhaps the most gratifying of all that I know about. A man came to us, referred by another agency, and his situation was this. He was a landlord. He had several low-rent homes and apartments around town, and a whole lot of things had happened all at once to leave him in virtually destitute. And so we gave him a grant, and about 4 months later, He came back to us and said that he was grateful to us for his help, and he paid back the grant with a considerable additional payment. And so it's a chance to do something for men who need help just to get back on their feet in some way or another and move on with their lives. Thanks for your generosity.
Thank you, Renee. Okay, please stand as you're able and join us in singing hymn 75, The Harp at Nature's Advent. So when I saw that the topic was the universe story, I was reminded of someone from my youth named Carl Sagan, who would talk about the millions and millions and millions of stars. Maybe it was billions. Billions and billions, yeah, because the B would be there. Still a lot to consider. Anyway, of course, Carl had that great TV show on Sundays. And I looked up some quotes from him, and especially one stood out in the light of all these tragic events that John Alou talked about. This one seems appropriate. Every one of us is, in the cosmic perspective, precious. If a human disagrees with you, let him live. In 100 billion galaxies, you will not find another. And secondly, more to the point of the universe topic, science is not only compatible with spirituality, it is a profound source of spirituality.
Dr. Johnson.
Yeah, it's been a hard week in the news. Another one. So much to reflect on. Racism, retribution, systemic injustice in our justice system, gun culture, violence at home and abroad. Again, our hearts are broken. Again, social media explodes with outrage, grief, and speculation. And meanwhile, our frustration, or at least mine, simmers because we don't know what we can do personally to have any impact. We can't even make sense of this mess. While radio surfing, I came across a Christian station where they were talking about the need for conversations about race and policing. And in time, they came to the solution that the gospel was the answer. And of course, this is where most of us throw up our hands and proclaim, of course, they always bend the situation to get to their gospel. Now, I heard it a little differently at this particular point in time, though. They have a system, a worldview, a comprehensive philosophical approach to the world, and everything fits into it. What a gift to possess. Through the centuries, people have turned to religion in sadness and confusion because for centuries, religion spelled out the answers. God was in control in meting out judgment, or would in the long run, or the world was chaotic, bouncing about by the whims of different gods, or the heavens brought order and the will of humans distorted it. Various messages came from different religions, but all of them gave their particular culture a worldview in which to operate, a way to anchor themselves, a source of hope, even if it had to seep in after death. With the Enlightenment, religious worldviews were challenged in Western Europe and the Americas. Evolution seemed to shove aside the Creator God. Scriptures faded in their trustworthiness as historical critical interpretation offered theories of how, when, and why individual people with particular agendas had assembled the Bible and other religious books. Science won, sort of. The edges of science felt hard and sharp. And so many questions went unanswered. Religion didn't die away, but connected to people to their ancestors and to one another. Their religious worldviews offered an ethical and moral framework and comfort in times of trouble and turmoil. And where was that guidance and consolation in the scientific world? That void led many people to choose religion over science, especially in places where they contradicted each other. Others dismissed religion altogether and claimed we needed only what was provable. And still others sought a middle ground, embracing science when it worked and leaving the rest to religion. Or they cobbled together a personal worldview that drew elements from science, from religion, here and there, whatever we can make it to whatever unique pattern they could discern. So in today's postmodern world, there is no single dominant worldview. Every day we see evidence of the clash of worldviews and perspectives. Even in this room, We do not share a common worldview, even though we have a lot in common. And many of us no longer have any coherent story to hang the pieces of our lives on. Each time we have found a story, it has failed the testing. That leaves us feeling anxious and unmoored in the best of times and without good coping strategies for dealing with the worst of times. We're anxious because we're always asking where we fit. Cosmologist Brian Schwimm says, "All professions, all work, all activity in the human world finds its essential meaning in the context of a people's cosmic story." Let me repeat at least part of that. All activity in the human world finds its meaning in the context of a people's cosmic story. What he's saying is we make sense of the world through story. That's part of how our brains are made. Origin stories are common to all civilizations, to all tribes, and they begin the work of telling us who we are, why we are, where we come from, and what we are about. And we know some of those stories, ancient ones from Greece and Rome, the Gilgamesh story, the Vedas, the oral stories transmitted by the Kaw and Lakota, and there are the biblical ones. Part of our problem, our lack of mooring, is that we know multiple stories rather than one. We're outside a cultural niche. We've seen too much of the world. If we are to have a religious story, we need a story that meets our tests of truth, that even accommodates different stories, that challenges us to be the best that we can be without burdening us with more than we can hope to accomplish, that reassures us that somehow all will be well, that there is order and goodness in the universe, but that does not sugarcoat the chaos and evil that exists. We need to know where and how we fit in, because that's what religion offers. So what if the religious story could be a scientific one? All of us know, some of us probably are, scientists who find an almost mystical sense in the truths of science. The natural world can offer awe and wonder. I'm sure we've all experienced that. It can even offer comfort. I think of activist farmer Wendell Berry's words, "When despair for the world grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water. And I feel above the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world and am free." But can that natural world, can the study of that natural world offer us a religious story? Imagery textured enough to excite our imaginations, a plot line clear enough that we can find ourselves in it, and grand enough that we can know it's not all about us. There are people who are trying to capture that scientific story as a religious one. Again, I quote from cosmologist Brian Schwimm, because he's one of the people who's been really active with that. The Universe is a Green Dragon is a book that he wrote that really started me on this exploration. He says, "The creation story unfurling within the scientific enterprise provides the fundamental context, the fundamental arena of meaning for all the peoples of the earth. For the first time in human history, we can agree on the basic story of the galaxies, the stars, the planets, minerals, life forms, and human cultures. This story does not diminish the spiritual traditions of the classical or tribal periods of human history. Rather, the story provides the proper setting for the teaching of all traditions, showing the true magnitude of their central truths. So Michael Dowd, who labels himself an eco-theologian, has appeared at lots of churches to sell the compatibility of religion with the scientific creation story. And his wife, Connie Barlow, is a scientist and educator, and she's an atheist Unitarian Universalist. And so they've included UU congregations and camps in their travels. Dowd proclaims, "Thank God for evolution." And he describes the great creation story this way. He says, it's the 14 billion year science-based sacred story of cosmic genesis, from the formation of the galaxies and the origin of Earth life to the development of self-reflective consciousness and collective learning, to the emergence of comprehensive compassion and tools to assist humanity in living harmoniously with the larger body of life. Some people talk about it as big history or universal history. Multidisciplinary, it draws on history, science, philosophy, and religion. And here is my retelling of the great sacred story of life. I occasionally quote Michael Dowd in this, but mostly not. But I wanted to string it together without throwing in, and this is a quote, yeah. So, some 15 billion years ago, it all started with a Big Bang, not the TV show. Something emerged somehow from the nothingness, something that would become our universe. At first, it seemed to be only energy, but then matter coalesced. Hydrogen first, then helium. The matter formed into stars. And from that stardust, everything came. Even us, in time. Other elements formed in some of the stars. The stars organized into galaxies, 100 billions of them. Our Milky Way galaxy is an elegant spiral. It takes 100,000 years for light to cross from one end to the other. As the spiral turns, stars are born from clouds of gas and elements formed by previous stars. Stars live, and then they die. One particular explosion, probably a supernova, produced waves that disturbed a cloud of gas and dust, and the clouds spun and then collapsed and formed our solar system. The hot, dense part in the center became the sun, while clumps circling around grew into planets and moons. The third planet, Earth, had special characteristics. Its temperature allowed liquid water to exist. Earth cooled, and a crust formed around the molten core, like a film on cooling pudding. Water vapor rose and formed clouds. The temperature dropped and the rains began. It rained on and on until the oceans came into being. And then something really amazing happened. Bacteria. All through the ocean, the first form of life, all other life needs them. We need them. They don't need us. In time, life learned to nourish itself from sunlight, creating photosynthesis. And what's the waste matter of photosynthesis? Oxygen. A crisis came when oxygen poisoned the atmosphere, threatening the anaerobic bacteria. Would it survive? It did. Found a way to cooperate. Symbiosis and multicellular plants developed. Together, cells could do what single cells could not do, diversify. Sexual reproduction produced new creativity on the planet. Death, too, came into existence. For the early bacterium, death was not an inevitability. Some of the earliest bacteria may still be with us today. For life forms that are sexual, though, death's an integral part of their existence. And death eliminates biological forms and cleans the slate for new genetic forms. Then life learned how to gain energy and sustenance by consuming other creatures instead of getting energy directly from the sun. Biological communities, ecosystems developed. Worms got nervous systems and brains, and then came backbones. Living beings came out of the ocean, as we heard in our story. First plants, then insects. Amphibians emerged later, then reptiles, and plants grew on the land, coniferous trees. And what did the reptiles become? Dinosaurs. And while they still lived, mammals started nursing their young. And birds appeared from the dinosaurs. And then an asteroid careened in the ocean and the dinosaurs died out. Plants, though, flowered, literally, exploding in color. Primates emerged, and finally, ape-like humans began to walk on 2 feet in the land we now call Africa. Our ancestors tamed fire and learned to use it. Homo sapiens developed an ability to think in a way different from other life. We became the piece of the universe able to reflect on ourselves and on our existence, on our universe, and on our story. A story far from over. Though we're able to think about our universe and our place, we've made many mistakes, and maybe an experiment gone awry. Keep in mind that we rely on the lowly bacterium and may underestimate the other creatures with whom we live. What can we learn from the story of the universe? Dowd and Barlow note 5 characteristics of this great story. First, it changes. Not only does the story change, but everything changes. All the time. Creation comes out of circumstances and intention, a never-ending process, which leads to the second characteristic. The great story isn't over. Evolution continues. Humanity is not what it will be, nor is anything else. Change is not just what has happened, but what is happening and what will happen. Third and fourth, this is a story that is both diverse and unified. Unified because science has a global perspective that allows integration of ideas from different sources, from different cultures. No single person or culture knows all the details of the story. Think for a moment about the scientific detail of the birth of stars. There are physicists who understand that. I don't, but they do. And then there are biologists who understand the emergence of the life of life more deeply than the physicists do. There are people who grasp the breadth of the story and others who gravitate to the details. Somehow it comes together and includes all of that. It's also a story with multiple interpretations. Humans make meaning. That's what we do. Often the facts alone are not enough to tell the whole story. There's not enough data for us to know how to respond, even when we need to respond. There are gaps we have to fill in with theories, which we try to find ways to test. We search through our experience, even if it's not systematic. We review other people's experience and the rich expanse of cultural expressions, and we find what seems right. Not in contradiction to what we know to be true, but in parallel with it. And finally, the fifth characteristic of the great story, it creates synergy between science and religion. Ancient stories, as beautiful, insightful, and inspirational as they may be, may be able to be reconciled with science, but they don't have scientific explanations integrated into them. The great story starts with the science, stays grounded in science, and at the same time strives to embrace and address the world's needs. It tries to offer us meaning and guidelines for ethical conduct. It helps us find our place in the world. To understand ourselves as an intimate part of an evolving universe invites us into a different kind of relationship with the rest of the universe. We are literally made of stardust. We are intimately related and connected to the trees, the ocean, the bacteria. We are their relatives. We are at home here and not alone, but surrounded by beauty, wonder, and inspiration. We belong here, and we are humbled by the vast expanses of the earth and the universe and of time itself. Peter Meyer, UU, wrote that song, and you might want to check out some of his other YouTube videos. He has another song that's called Holy Now, and in it he describes his disillusionment with the Catholicism he grew up with. Then, back then, he saw only certain things, the consecrated host, the Bible, the stories of miracles, those were holy, and the other things, the worldly things, were not. And now he says everything is holy. Everything is a miracle. And when I think of the universe story, I believe that it is a miracle. We may have a scientific explanation of how life came into being, how people came to be, how we come into being, but has anyone held a newborn child without feeling the presence of something so amazing that it has to be called miraculous? It's the same sentiment that Emerson spoke of when he said that the blowing clover was more miracle than the healings of Jesus. Yesterday, I watched the clouds. They weren't particularly spectacular clouds, not unusual. I watched as tiny strands of them zigzagged down, sinking, and because some clouds are heavier than others. And I noticed the multiple shades of white and wondered what it said about the density. It's that awe, that sense of awe is all connected in with this universe we live in. So the universe story can reclaim for us a sense of awe and wonder. How, though, does it give us meaning or hope? How does it ground us in times of trouble and inspire us to do more in times of comfort? And I can only answer that for myself. When I realize the enormity and complexity of the world, it can be frustrating or it can be freeing. I've lived long enough to know that I can't know how any particular piece is going to come out. I don't know. It's a collective enterprise. Each of us, human and non-human, has our small contribution to make, and somehow that is enough. We've not yet evolved, I don't think, for the conditions we're living under. As biologist E.O. Wilson has said, we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology. Not a good combination. We've got those workings of our lower brains and limbic systems, and it's amazing we haven't destroyed ourselves already. The bright spot is that we're beginning to know and understand ourselves, our brains, our neurology, ourselves better. And that's part of that combination of science and religion, too, part of the universe story. And perhaps we will know enough soon enough to avoid the dangers that Wilson sees. The universe keeps growing, more diverse, more cooperative, without me needing to push it. What works succeeds, what doesn't dies, and that's fine. lost in the whirl of the ages and the breadth of the cosmos, I can rest in uncertainty. And so for today, for this moment, I do not need to know the solutions to the complex social, legal, and moral issues of the moment. I will keep wrestling with them. I'll keep showing up where I think I need to show up and working for what I see as justice. But I'm not in charge. All I do is play my role. And for today, this reflection is my role. I'm like Li Po, the 8th century Chinese poet who wrote, "Since water still flows, though we cut it with swords, and sorrows return, though we drown them with wine, since the world can in no way answer to our craving, I will loosen my hair tomorrow and take to a fishing boat." And so he played his role. And it's your turn now, if you have something you'd like to share or ask or speculate on. And I see hands coming and mics coming.
Thank you, John Lu. My name is Kathy Hedge, and in the last comments that you were making, I was thinking that yesterday I was moping around thinking, God, it's so bad, everything's so bad. And I just had to remember that when I first started teaching, I wanted to adopt students that I knew had all the potential, but their home situation was such a mess that I couldn't see a hope for them. And then I realized, thank goodness, that I could not adopt all these children. And this is something I would share when I was mentoring young teachers. And that was that you can't take all of these children home and fix their lives. But what you can do is make the hour that they're with you the very best part of their day. And I think that's kind of what you're referring to. I can't change this all, but I can do this part that fits in my life and do the best I can at that.
It's one of the lessons of an ecosystem, isn't it? An ecosystem has all these different parts, and each animal, each plant plays its role in the ecosystem. And if we take that as a model and recognize, I have my role, you have your role, let's play our roles, let's do what we're called to do, and let it fall into place.
Jim Chanteau. When I'm feeling depressed and pessimistic, I think of an argument I heard from some people who were looking at the absence of evidence coming from radio telescopes that had not measured anything anywhere in the universe that looked like intelligent life. They've been looking for 50, 60 years now and still have not found anything. And one conclusion could be that there simply isn't anything else out there. Or the more pessimistic view is that there was, but they destroyed themselves, as we are in the process of doing as well. And that there may be simply a point that any organized organism develops to a point that it destroys itself and its planet or wherever it's living. That's a pretty pessimistic view, but it does account for a lot. In my more optimistic days, however, I think back to a lesson I learned in Boy Scouts, which is every campground you find, leave it cleaner than you found it when you arrived. And I've always sort of made that my goal in life, is to make everything a little bit better than when I arrived. And if we all did that, I think we can avoid the pessimistic outcome of that I described earlier.
Christopher Renner, I have a couple of not necessarily coherent thoughts together. First is, when I first read the title of your speech, I was thinking we were going to get more into Genesis chapter 1. On the first day, there was, and so forth and so on. And what's really interesting is when I took scripture course back in college, of course, one of the first things my scripture professor taught me was that there's chapter 1 and then there's chapter 2.
That's right.
And there's two completely different stories. And so often our fundamentalist brethren on the right tend to forget chapter 2. And I think it's interesting about how they are using that. The other thing that always comes to mind when we talk about the universe is a discussion I had when I was still quite young, probably 10 years old. I had a cousin who was a Redemptorist priest, and he was trying to explain to me the concept of space and time and how me caught up in the Apollo missions and going to the moon, no, you're not going to be able to go to Saturn and come back in a day. And he was trying to explain this concept. That's still something that I think we all struggle with, the real concept of how big this place is that we are in the middle of. And I think we also lose in that process the concept that we're just a little tiny speck in a very, very, very large ocean. And, you know, I really see that play out in priorities and not wanting to take responsibility for action. And if we talk about the last few weeks in our history of our country and the constant barrage of assault rifles, you know, really, folks, it's a really basic thing. We need to realize that we're in this with everybody. And I think that's really one of the challenges we have to try to figure out. How can we get over this self-centered that the universe starts with me and realize that we're just that small speck?
A few times I've had the opportunity to do an exercise that's a solar system walk with kids, where you take a basketball that's basically the equivalent of the sun, and then to represent the planets, they're slightly different size, but there's the Earth is a peppercorn, and I think Mercury is a pinhead, and others, and then you walk to put them in order, you know, to put them in their places, these little tiny things, and you see how much space there is. I mean, because you have to walk like over a mile to get the solar system laid out. It's a really incredible experience because you really see how much of it is just space, emptiness. Yeah, scale is really an important thing.
Mark Mayfield, I realize how important it is to have a wife that's always thinking about you. And while she was in the library this week, she picked up a book called Prairie Earth, I think. Mm. Is that the whole name? Probably not. But anyway, many of you have probably read it, but it has a whole lot of really nice quotes at the very beginning about basically our connection to the Earth. And I feel like that was a great introduction to this whole theme, and perhaps part of the answer to all of our questions is I think that the theme of that book is that if you can give people that connection to the Earth, I think it gives them meaning. And,
yes.
And part of the way to do that is through some sort of a story that connects us all. But anyway, and I think part of the theme that's developed in the book is about Kansas's place in the geological history of the world, of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And it's a really nice book. If you haven't read it, you should.
Diane Barker. I think the thing that we're challenged with understanding now is our amount of energy consumption and how outrageous it's become. Every time you turn on a light, you've burned a lump of coal. Each American burns 20 pounds of coal a day. When you drive an automobile, it's the equivalent of having 450 slave hours or something like that if you go a certain distance. It's kind of like, I don't have the particulars in my head right now, but after reading Richard Heinberg's Power Down, The Party's Over, Big Coal, everything I can get my hands on about energy production and consumption, we don't need new technologies. We just need to get a grip. So I think we also are partially recovered from every Christmas they used to come out with all kinds of new electrical appliances. You know, like suddenly you needed an electric nail buffer or a new electric toast butterer, something. So I would just like to get everyone to focus on just use the energy that you need and not more. Thanks.
Yeah, part of our recognizing our connection and our place is understanding what resources we consume. Yeah, it's an important part of it.
Hi, Mark Clark here. If this interested you at all, we're going to be diving into something a little bit different, but certainly along the same lines. Larry Weaver and I are going to be providing the content in August the 4th or 11th or some other day.
It's the first Sunday in August, whatever that is.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Yeah, I guess I better get writing it then. But it's about the size of things. The size of things as they relate to one another, as well as how different societies in different ages viewed the size of things, all the way from the microscopic and below to the size of galaxies and, in fact, the whole universe. So I invite everybody to show up for that.
And that was our paid commercial
plug.
Endorsement, right.
Good morning, Anna Franklin. The one thing that I hear everyone dancing around, well, that's what I hear. It might not be what you hear. In the Yoga Sutra, there is one sutra that I call the Altruism Sutra. So I just want to say altruism, you know, when we see the miracle and the beauty and the things that unify us all and the wonder of it all, and we feel that emotion, then we can feel something called altruism, which is compassion, kindness, desire to help, and so on. But we have to remember that the conditions have to be right, mm-hmm. just like the conditions for life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when we can feel that connection with one another and with our earth, then we're better able to do that, yeah, to feel the compassion.
My mother was born in a sod house in the middle of nowhere in the sand hills of Nebraska, and didn't have a lot of formal education, but she was an avid reader and imparted all sorts of information and suggestions for better living to the five of us in the family. And one of the things she said was that immortality is inescapable, that what we do will live after us. And it's been kind of a heavy burden to have to keep this in mind, that the things we do, the lives we touch, the resources we use to access all of the rest is part of a legacy that is something to keep in mind.
I'm always intrigued by science and spirituality, and often I'm trying to get a little bit of a perspective or a grasp on large numbers or infinitesimally small things, whether it's the bacteria in our gut or the national debt or the space between stars. But I've found for myself I get just a little bit of glimpse of perspective when I consider that a second, which time is something we can relate to in some way, that a million seconds are a little shy of 12 days. A billion seconds are over 32 years. And so our debt is a trillion, of course.
I think we've probably reached a time when we should join together in our closing hymn, number 343, A Fire Mist and a Planet. I invite you to rise in body and or spirit. The words of Albert Schweitzer seem appropriate. I've altered them for inclusivity. Let someone once begin to think about the mystery of their life and the links which connect them with the life that fills the world, and they cannot but bring to bear upon their own life and all other life that comes within reach the principle of reverence for life. We go from this place feeling that reverence in all we say and do.